Hi guys, so today we're going to talk about hypovolemic shock. I'm planning on doing like a shock series and going over each kind of shock. It's very typical that you'll have a unit exam on all the shocks together. And sometimes it's hard to keep them straight. So this is my favorite shock. So this is probably going to be a two-part video just because there's so much to say about this particular shock. So let's get started. Hypovolemic shock occurs when there's low fluid volume in the intravascular system. That is like the textbook definition. So if there is a decrease in volume of blood in a person's circulatory system, the heart has nothing to pump at all. If the amount of blood that the heart pumps to the organs and tissues decreases, the cardiac output decreases. This leads to decreased tissue perfusion, which will alter the function of all the cells, which will limit their access to oxygen, which shock ensues, hypoxia ensues, multiple organ dysfunction ensues. So it's a chain of events, obviously. So a person needs to lose about 15% or more of their intravascular volume for hypovolemic shock to occur. Now, I know that when you think this, you think blood, but that's not the case. There's things like burns, which that's a whole other topic. Burns are so complex and they're so great to study because there are so many things that can happen with somebody who has burns, so many different outcomes. So you can absolutely have hypovolemic shock with a burn. So it's not just only blood. There's many, many things that can cause hypovolemic shock. And we're going to go over those a little bit because sometimes your tests are probably not going to be that specific, or they might throw some of these at you. I don't know how in-depth it's going to be, but I say it's always good to know a disease process through and through and the treatment through and through. A person needs to lose about 15% or more of their intravascular volume, like I said. And if you were wondering, well, what's 15%? The average human has 5 liters of blood. So for example, if a person loses 1 liter of blood, that's 20%, and they'll start showing signs and symptoms of hypovolemic shock. So if I can say that one more time so you understand it. A person has 5 liters of blood. The average human has 5 liters of blood. And if I lose 1 liter of blood, that's 20%. And we need how many percentages to show signs and symptoms of shock? 15%. So 15% is what you need to show signs and symptoms of shock. So if you lose 1 liter of blood, you are absolutely going to start showing signs and symptoms of hypovolemic shock. So there's causes of hypovolemic shock. These kind of you need to like commit to memory, but basically, a relative hypovolemic shock is an inside fluid shift from the intravascular system, and this is more concealed. So this might be like you're bleeding in the belly in a trauma. You can see it, but it's there. And third spacing of fluid, which is like what happens in burns, that's super complex, and it's one of my most favorite topics. So whenever we get to that video, it's going to be like 100 years long because I love it so much. A fracture of a long bone. So I always use this example. You break your femoral, your femur, and you nick your femoral artery. So that is a concealed shock. So it's relative. Remember, relative, concealed. Damage to organs like the pancreas or anything, like an acute pancreatitis. And just like a little tidbit, I don't know if this is like part of paramedic education. I remember like this a little bit, but things might have changed. Acute pancreatitis, you'll see like the Cullen sign or the Turner sign, which is like the bruising on the lower back and the bruising around the belly button. Those are like very late signs of bleeding. That's relative hypovolemic shock. So massive vasodilation from septic shock, and we'll get into sepsis in another video. Absolute hypovolemic shock. It's things that you can actually see that are leaving the body. A huge laceration on the arm and you're bleeding. A massive bleeding from an injury or surgery, like heart surgery or like abdominal surgery. Excessive fluid loss from vomiting, diarrhea, urine, sweating. So like somebody who, a good patient population to remember for something like this is infants, children. They can be affected by this so much worse. So if you have a child with excessive vomiting and diarrhea, that child will probably enter shock a lot quicker than an adult because they cannot compensate like we do. Sweating can be caused by an endocrine disorder. That's like very rare. I mean, I wrote it down here because it's always a chance, you know, you want to know everything, but, sometimes sweating from some of these endocrine disorders can cause hypovolemic shock, but we'll focus on like the things that are pretty like obvious. So I always like to do this chain again at some point when I'm talking about this. So hypovolemic shock, I want you to write an arrow in between these. Hypovolemic shock, arrow, decreases the amount of venous return to the heart. Arrow, decreases preload, arrow, decreases stroke volume, decreases cardiac output, and cardiac output should be pumping 4 to 8 liters a minute, by the way. Cardiac output equals heart rate times stroke volume. So I'm going to say that again. Hypovolemic shock decreases the amount of venous return to the heart, then decreases preload, then decreases stroke volume, then decreases cardiac output. So that's why our cardiac output goes down during hypovolemic shock. If cardiac output falls too low, the amount of blood that should be going to the organs and tissues per minute will drastically fall. Decreased oxygen in tissues and organs means hypoxic injury of the cell. So, you know, we have these giant arteries that feed things like our kidneys and, you know, we're not getting enough perfusion there. And that's not good. That means that we're going to have kidney damage, or we're not getting enough perfusion to the brain. That's not good. That means that we're going to enter hypoxia. And, you know, those manifestations of hypoxia are like cyanotic lips, cyanotic hands, things like that. I think that's covered more in EMT, though. I think you guys would know something like that. The body is going to try to compensate by activating the sympathetic nervous system, which will trigger the body's internal built-in survival system. Our internal built-in survival system is made to take over and be like, okay, that's it. You know, we're shunting, we're taking perfusion away from the things that are not absolutely vital. The skin is one of them, which is why people in hypovolemic shock will appear pale. Based on the percentage of the fluid volume that's lost, it'll determine the signs and the symptoms that the patient may present at what stage they're in. This is what's so tricky about hypovolemic shock. There are actual stages. Now, you're going to say, oh my God, but pre-hospital care, we don't have to know the stages, all that stuff. Well, you probably should, just because I'm going to tell you why. You guys are going to take the national. I took the national. The national is very specific, and they want you to know these types of specifics. So I think it's easier for you to know this now instead of sitting down and cramming it all in before you take your national exam. Also, I don't know if your teacher has an affinity for things like this, like I do. And he might say, or she might say, oh, you know, I'm going to double down on this kind of shock. So it's always good to know, the stages and like what percentage they're associated with, more or less. So class one is less than 15% of volume loss. So if you want to make that into mLs, because I'm sure they'll ask you to convert it, less than 15% of volume loss is about 750 mLs in an adult. So at this stage, the body can maintain cardiac output with this volume loss. The patient is typically asymptomatic. Everything is like within normal limits. Never say within normal limits in class, though. Like, nobody likes that. It's something that you kind of say after you work for a little while, but you don't say that like on reports and things like that, because normal, there is no definition of normal. So just like disregard whenever I say that. Everything's within normal limits, maybe except for mental status. A little bit anxious. They're a little anxious. Class 2 is 15 to 30% of volume loss, typically like 750 mls to 1500 mls in an adult. So cardiac output is starting to fall due to the volume loss. Major system compensation via the sympathetic nervous system is going to start. And the renin-angiotensin system, which is the shunting of the vital organs. Now, they're gonna the skin is gonna say, "Oh my god!" But we don't need our skin to have blood perfusion right now. We need our kidneys to have blood perfusion. So that's what's gonna happen. Heart rate is typically greater than 100 because this the sympathetic nervous system is going to be activated. So you might think. This is what I used to think. You might think, well, it's hypovolemic shock. Isn't my patient going to have bradycardia? No, they're going to have tachycardia. And they're going to have tachycardia because the heart is trying to compensate. It thinks that if it squeezes and it squeezes really fast and you have, you know, tachycardia like 150, it's going to pump more blood out to try to perfuse those organs, but there's nothing to pump out. That's what the heart thinks. It doesn't know what's going on. So that's why we have tachycardia. So if an instructor ever asks you, you know, do patients in hypovolemic shock have tachycardia or bradycardia? The answer is tachycardia, and you can go ahead and tag on an explanation to that too, so you can show that you know your material. Blood pressure may decrease in this stage too. But still within normal limits, you might have like a 95 systolic blood pressure. It's a little low. Some people run low. I run low, like, you know, but maybe a touch lower than normal. And that's because the body's mechanism of action is working. Their way of being able to compensate. At this point, this patient is compensating. They're compensating for the blood loss, stage 2. Urine output may start to lower. Not really a concern for pre-hospital. 20 cc's an hour, but you don't really need to know that. Blood flow is going to be shunted and body will start to keep water and aldosterone and ADH will be released due to angiotensin 2. So basically, since we don't have blood, we're going to stop making urine. Because why? Because we're not getting perfusion to our kidneys. So how are we going to make urine? We're not. We're going to shunt it somewhere else. So the blood loss, the perfusion, we're going to shunt it somewhere else. So that's the whole idea behind knowing that. However, you know, you might need to know that, like, at this point, your patient's not going to make any urine. Skin is going to be cool, clammy. Like I said, the skin doesn't need the perfusion anymore. Something else more important does, like your brain, like maybe your kidneys, something else. Increased cap refill is going to be more than 2 seconds. This is key when doing this assessment for your lab finals or your mega codes, whatever they give you. You want to get a cap refill that is a great, quick indicator. You don't have time to put a blood pressure cuff on this patient and take a blood pressure manually. You can give them a quick squeeze on their hand and you can get a pretty okay picture of how that perfusion is going. And if it's more than 2 seconds, you're starting to enter into problems. So they're going to have diminished peripheral pulses. Why? Because blood is shunting towards the center of their body because the ends don't need it right now. The center needs it, the trunk. They're going to have some anxiety. They're going to start to show some like mental status changes, but nothing like, I don't know where I'm at. It's more like just anxiety. Vasoconstriction is happening right now to shunt blood to the vital organs, like I said before. So as a summation of stage 2 or class 2, the patient's going to be tachycardic, hypotensive, mildly, and tachypneic. They're going to breathe faster. So I want you to stop for a second. And even if you haven't gotten into this yet, what are some things that you think could be potentially a problem for this patient? they're tachycardic, they're hypotensive, and they're tachypneic. When you breathe too fast, what do you blow off too much of? You blow off too much CO2. So that means that you become alkalotic. What kind of alkalosis can this patient throw themselves into during their hypovolemic shock? Depends if it's metabolic or respiratory. But they can throw themselves into alkalosis if they breathe too fast. So that's just something for you to chew on a little bit to try to think about what are the problems later that may happen. Probably even after you drop the patient off to the hospital, but that's something good to think about. And it's things that the national paramedic exam does test you on. So you may have to study a little bit more on the specifics. So class 3 is 30 to 40% of volume loss. In mLs, that is 1,500 to 2,000 mLs in an adult. They're going to be tachycardic, over 120 beats per minute. Their respiratory rate is going to increase. They may progress into respiratory failure. Why? Because they may have thrown themselves into alkalosis. They're going to be hypotensive for sure. We're talking systolic blood pressures less than 90, maybe 80. They're going to have oliguria, which is no urine. They're going to go into renal failure because they're not getting that perfusion to their kidneys like they're supposed to. If you're in a hospital setting, they're going to have a high BUN and creatinine because those are the markers that we use to see if their kidney function is good or not. They're going to have terrible peripheral pulses. Their skin is going to be cool, mottled. Their cap refill is going to be more than 2 seconds for sure. Super anxious, super confused. They may at this point go into metabolic acidosis because at this point, that's why you need to read about this a little bit more before you take the national, because this is something that the national doubles down on and they will ask you all of the other questions that maybe you didn't go through in your paramedic education. But they may go into acidosis because you switch from, I'm pretty sure it's anaerobic to aerobic, and you might have a high lactic acid and that's not good. So the picture right now that you need to see is that this patient is bad. This patient's bad, and you may have to control an airway soon if you don't fix it. So, that I'm going to get to that in a little bit, the treatment, but the treatment is basically fluids and fly to the hospital if you're pre-hospital. So, they're going to have low O2 and low perfusion to the brain. So they're going to be super confused. Where am I at? What are you doing? Anxious. Why are you touching me? Or they're going to start to become altered mental. They might lose a little bit of consciousness. Their GCS might go down. So now we have class 4, which is really bad. And that is more than 40% volume loss, which is more than 2,000 mLs in an adult loss. I wrote here, death is near. It is near, very near. This needs very dynamic treatment that can only be provided in hospital. If your patient is like this in the back of your truck, that's bad. That's not a good situation at all. It might be a little too late, but this patient at this stage needs a lot of dynamic treatment. I'm talking physicians, surgeons, respiratory therapists, nurses, anybody, all these people, very dynamic way of treating this patient at this point, because all of these other problems will occur over hypovolemic shock. Increased respiratory rate or none at all, or severe hypotension, anuria, lifeless, maybe a coma, maybe pulseless at this point. And obviously when they become pulseless, now you start CPR and do your entire management of that. So now symptoms depend on the stage, but in a nutshell, this is what I want you to take away from this. Tachycardia, hypotension, cool and clammy skin, weak peripheral pulses, anxiety, decreased urinary output, central venous pressures will be low, And if they're on hemodynamic monitoring, CVP levels will be low. The only reason I included that was because in the last podcast, I saw that there was some information on central venous pressures that was on my fiance's syllabus. So that's why I included this. Treatment goals, fluid resuscitation. Pre-hospital care, hang fluid, run it wide open, and fly to the hospital. So that's your priority pre-hospital. Correct the underlying cause that is leading to the fluid loss if you can see it. So if the patient has a big gaping wound, you may need to apply a tourniquet. You might need to apply lots of pressure and do your like first aid type of things in order to decrease that bleeding. But if it's fluid, if it's a relative hypovolemic shock and you can't see it and it's concealed, there's not much you can do. Hang fluid and get to the hospital. So a little bit of things that you might want to do in the back of the truck: monitor oxygenation and perfusion status. Keep checking those cap refills. Keep checking those O2 sats. Place them on oxygen. They need it because they're not perfusing. May need intubation. You might have to tube them because they might stop breathing or they might be breathing too fast. If they're bleeding, like, and it's obvious, you might need to hold firm direct pressure. Place in a modified Trendelenburg, which is supine, and their feet are at 45 degree angles. This promotes blood flow back to the brain. Now, don't do this with spinal or head trauma. That's the caveat there. Don't do that with anybody who has spinal, like suspected C-spine or any type of like head trauma. So, you know, that might include a lot of people because like, let's say you have a MVC or a motorcycle accident and somebody is hypovolemic, they're in hypovolemic shock, very like obviously, and you can't place them in this position because we don't know if they hurt their spine when they were ejected off the motorcycle or if they, you know, were whiplashed or whatever. So that can, you can do that, but that's more of like a different type of injury, like burns. This increases the venous return to the heart. And this increases the venous return to the, like the upper portion of the body. You want to get 2 large bore IVs, and I'm talking the biggest that you can find. Typically textbook 18 and bigger, but you want to get big veins, preferably ACs, 2 of them. In case one stops working, you can use the other one. Some people hang fluids on both IVs. I've seen traumas come in with IV bags on each arm. So that might be what you would have to do. And the fluids for hypovolemic shock would be like crystalloids, so like normal saline or lactated Ringer's. Lactated Ringer's is not available on the truck, so it would be normal salines. These are volume expanders. They add more fluid to the intravascular system, increasing preload, stroke volume, and cardiac output. So if you get a question on a test, what kind a fluid are you going to give to someone who has hypovolemic shock? You want to give a crystalloid, which is normal saline, because like I said, it's a volume expander. It's going to expand that volume. It's going to add more fluid into the intravascular system, which we need it, because we need to increase preload. We need to increase stroke volume, because that increases cardiac output, which we have none of right now. So most commonly started on a crystalloid solution. This goes back to pre-hospital. Even like in the hospital, we expect anybody who comes in as a trauma to be started on some type of crystalloid. In the truck, it just gets the ball rolling with you know, aggressive fluid challenges. So watch for fluid volume overload. Honestly, like, I guess you should, like, pre-hospital, but the chances of that happening are, like, low. That's more for, like, in-hospital. This was a big one when I was in paramedic school. You want to auscultate lungs before you place them in Trendelenburg or give fluids, because you want a baseline. Before you do anything to your patient, you want to check what you're about to do before you do it, if that makes any sense. That sounds like Chinese, but you don't want to give fluid without checking vital signs. You want your pre-vitals, and then you want your post-vitals. So you want your vital signs before you gave a medication and then after you give a medication. So same thing goes for hanging a fluid challenge. You want to get some vitals before, and you're going to have to listen to their lungs. You want at least bare minimum a blood pressure and auscultate their lungs before you challenge them with a fluid challenge, because you want to know if their lungs are wet before, because if their lungs are wet, that's not good. You don't want to make them more wet. You don't want to put more fluid in their lungs. Then you're going to, like, they're going to have trouble breathing. Now you're creating a whole other problem. And I remember this has happened to me. I remember having a scenario in paramedic school. I didn't check lung sounds. And of course, because you know how these professors are, these teachers or instructors, whatever we call them, but they love to turn the scenario on you and be like, well, now they have too much fluid in their lungs because you didn't check their lung sounds before. And that's how you learn from those situations. Colloids are not available pre-hospital, so I'm not really going to go over that. Giving a large amount of fluid, we have to warm them to prevent hypothermia, because it affects our clotting enzymes and it keeps the patient warm, but not to the point of sweating. I don't think that there's a way to warm these in the truck, but I'm pretty sure that they are not going to be super cold. And I'm, you know, utilize the things around you, utilize the blankets, you know, keep the patient warm. You know, it'll help them. It'll help you, the fluid challenge work better, you know, on the way to the hospital. So just for, like, if you're wondering, what's a cure for this? Blood products, packed red blood cells, platelets, fresh frozen plasma. These things are the things that patients need when they're in hypovolemic shock, but that is not available in a truck, which is why wherever you are at, if you have this kind of patient, depending on what class it is, all you really need to do is hang fluid, monitor this patient like every 5 minutes, because they're a critical patient, and get to the hospital, because ultimately the treatment can only be done in the hospital. So that's pretty much it for hypovolemic shock. I'm going to continue doing this with other shocks. I didn't have to make this video into two parts, which is great. I got all of the information out there pretty under 30 minutes. It's okay. But I'm going to do another shock, and I'll keep going through the shocks and keep going through the syllabus in that order. This is just a really big subject, and it's good to have an understanding of it pretty early in the game, so you know kind of like what you're looking at when it's presented to you. This is one of the subjects that you should read about before you go to class. So that way you read about it before you go to class, you hear about it in class, and then when you study for your exam, that's the third time you're going over it. By that time, you'll have it down through and through. So. All right, guys, good luck. Thanks for listening.